Okay, I believe we're live. I think our mics are back on and we are live streaming. If I could have your attention, we will go ahead and reconvene this study session. We were in the middle of an excellent discussion with two representatives from PARA, and we'd very much like to continue that. I think we're in the questions from the board category right now. So are there additional questions that you would like to ask colleagues that have not been answered?
Well, I've got, am I on? I hope so. We have a historic return rate of 9.8%. That's the number on one of the slides. And you said that we've now changed our baseline to be 5.2%?
Nope. Changed it now 7.25 is the assumed.
7.25, all right.
Yep. 5.2 is what we've earned over the last 10 years.
Okay. All right. So that included the recession years, pretty much.
Correct. Right. I have the numbers.
Okay, that's fine. I just had misunderstood you. The second point I guess I want to make to those who may not be familiar with this is that what happens with PARA happens to us as a district. We don't get to make any decisions about what the benefits are, what the investment is, what our contribution is. This board doesn't make any of those decisions. But what is certain is that the money that we get to run the schools is finite, and the demands on that budget are pretty well defined. And so the reality is that when the employer contribution is increased dramatically, it has the very real impact of reducing what we're able to do when it comes to more direct compensation. And so our staff, our employees should make no mistake that even though you in your presentation have defined it as here's the employee's contribution increase and here's the employer's contribution increase, they really are both the employee's contribution increase because you have reduced our ability to give compensation increases more directly.
Because it's a total comp thing. I totally get that.
Okay.
And if I may, we are 100% aware of that. As an employee of the district, I'm certainly aware of that.
Yeah.
I think really whether it's an employee or an employer bucket that money comes out of really has determines a lot more what happens on the backside than the front side. From the front side budgeting standpoint, I completely agree with your analysis. From the backside, if it goes in as an employee contribution, one of the benefits of that is that it goes into a member account. One of the things that's forgotten in this is that, you know, PARA is not a huge conglomerate of funds. It is, while there is a lot of funds invested on behalf of all the membership, there are individual accounts with an individual dollar amount. And there are benefits associated with being a PARA member that also don't have, you know, a dollar sign attached to them. And the money that goes in as an employee contribution belongs to that member, earns interest. And if they leave the system, you know, well before retirement age and elect to do so, they can take that money with them. That's unlike the employer dollars, which in large part at this point are going to pay the unfunded liability. So really it's more of a functional difference on the backside than maybe a budgeting difference for you in your seat. And we appreciate that.
In other words, employer dollars are worth more to the pension system than employee dollars.
But from your perspective. I appreciate that perspective. That helps, actually.
Yep.
Thank you.
So you have as a goal, I think a stated goal, that we would become somehow, hopefully, within a 30-year period, 100% actuarially sound or actuarially funded or whatever term you guys use for that. But I think you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. I'm having citizens or friends ask me occasionally, why does it have to be 100%? What if we set a goal to be 80% actuarially sound or completely funded? Would we not then be in pretty good shape? And so is this 100% some magic unrealistic number?
Well, I think There's a couple reasons. I think from a legal perspective and a statute perspective, our board has a set goal in our statute that 30-year amortization is actuarially sound. That's number one. But more probably importantly than that, I think any plan that only gets you to 80% funded, if we go back to a slide and that gets you to 100% funded, any plan that gets you to 80% funded has a much different slope. And that slope of the line is really important. And what it does is if we hover around that 60% line, rather than kind of start going up to that 100% line, the risks are still too great from an investment perspective. And so I think we've had a lot of people say just that. And what that really means is don't do as much to our benefits or our contributions, because we just want to get to 80% funded. And the problem with that is we think there's still too much risk there, and we think sound policy is to get to 100% within 30-year period. So I think that would be my answer. Marcus, do you have?
Well, I mean, I think from a budgeting perspective, I'm trying to see this through your eyes as much as I can.
You're next.
I'm going to eventually pay off my house. And when I've got 80% equity and I'm looking at going to my retirement years, I'm not going to keep refinancing my house every year to maintain 80% equity. At some point, I'm just going to pay it off and have the actual payment go from my mortgage and the interest on it to my property tax. And that's one of the things that's, I think, lost in this discussion. The actual cost of the pension is much lower than what is being paid in by employers right now. The cost that we're paying off is a liability that has already been accrued by people who have already provided service, and it's money that they are owed. It is simply deferred contributions that we must pay, regardless of any plan that anyone would present that we could do differently. That unfunded liability exists and must be funded. If we get to the point where there's a small slice of it left, we say, well, nah, let's not pay it off. That ensures that we will always be paying interest on an unfunded liability. That rolls us back to an open 30-year period where we're just continually paying debt service that we don't need to. So while I appreciate it as perhaps a way to maintain benefit levels, I think because it increases the investment profile risk and it ensures an ongoing cost, that it's not wise financial policy. Now, ultimately, as Adam said, the legislature sets the benefits and the contributions. These are our board's recommendations, but I hope it helps you to understand the reasoning behind it.
And the sooner the unfunded liability is paid off, the sooner we can free up budget money because once the unfunded liability is paid off, we don't need 20% of pay to pay off the unfunded liability. In fact, the cost of the benefit's going to be about 10% at that point, maybe even less. So you only need maybe the employee contribution or a fraction of the employer contribution. So the faster we pay off that past debt, the quicker we can free up money for our employers.
So I've got a few questions. I remember a time when PARA was fully funded, mm-hmm. and I would like to hear when that was and how we got where we are now, abbreviated from that time. And
that's difficult for us.
And I'm hearing you say that our levers are COLAs and contribution rates. And so I also heard you say earlier adjustments could go the other way as well. And I just heard you say that now. I would like to hear a scenario where adjustment rates for not just COLAs but contribution rates might go the other way.
So we were fully funded in the late 90s, 99, I think we were 102% funded. And a couple things happened, and I'll just give you broad strokes. Contributions were lowered. There was a feeding frenzy on the plan. Contributions were lowered, and benefits were increased, as well as people were able to purchase service credit at very low rates. You may have heard about this at a fraction of what the actuarial cost is. People were taking advantage of it. They were mortgaging their homes to purchase service credit. It cost the system significantly. But really, it was the lowering of contributions and the increasing of retirement, or lowering the retirement age, increasing retirement benefits, went from a fluctuating COLA to a fixed 3.5% compounded COLA. I like to say what's happening is we're now rolling back what was done to us when we were 100% funded. I mean, it's kind of that.
Mm-hmm.
Where the legislature did things to us that, you know, if you had double-digit returns as we did in the 90s, we obviously would be able to afford those. But the problem is we had the dot-com bust in 2002, and then we had the Great Recession, the financial crisis in 2008. And we've been slowly getting back to where we need to be based on those financial or those investment issues. To your second question, and that's just broad strokes, I hope helped answer that question. The second question is, we could certainly see a way that contributions are decreased and annual increases or COLAs are increased, and we have those caps that we talked about. Really simple way to think about it is, you know, we have about a 15% return. It's not final, but for 2017, that'll be about what the return is. If we had another 15% return year this year and another one next year, we would be ahead of where we need to be to pay, assuming the package passes, we would be ahead of where we need to be to pay off that unfunded liability within the 30-year period. And you could see a give back of a portion of the COLA and a reduction in the contribution rates. That's the most likely, that's the scenario I see as potential for how we would change it the other way.
Is that identified in the package or no?
Yes.
Okay.
There are specific times in which it would be adjusted in that manner. It's actually in draft legislation.
And that's where it gets hard, because it's just, we don't have a bill to talk about. Right? So we're talking about the board's recommendations, and I think we're just going to have to wait a little longer to have an actual bill to take a look at the details of how that might be implemented. But some of the issues that Ms. Stevens brought up about the implementation and the delay in between, there's competing issues. The longer we wait when we have market returns that require more contributions and to keep more money in the fund so that the risk profile remains low, we'd like that as short as possible. Employers need a little bit more time to budget for that. So we're going to have to meet in the middle somewhere, I think, and all the different groups are having good discussions about those particular issues, because we certainly don't want a bill that's unworkable for our employers. One of our mission vision statements is to be the retirement plan of choice for all of our employees and our employees. I would want you to join PARA today if you had that option. I want PARA to be strong for you and for the members. And so we certainly don't want a bill that's unworkable for you.
Ultimately, final decisions will be made under the Gold Dome. I want to ask you a question, Mr. Pinnell. Did I interrupt you, Susan?
No.
I want to ask you a question. You are a classroom teacher. You teach in Jefferson County. We can both be proud of that. If you were coming into the profession today as a new teacher, would you believe that PARA, as proposed to our legislature, is still a recruitment tool for us in the education profession? We have used it as such for a long time.
Yes.
Okay.
I can go on if you want.
I do. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, Marcus. I think it's an important question that we...
I do too.
...that we put in front of us clearly.
I do too.
It is part of our recruitment of teachers.
I think there's a couple of real issues that you have to talk about there, and one of them is demographics. you know, the new teachers that you're hiring. We have a lot of teachers that we hire that are mid-career. They've come from somewhere else. Para has some features where you can come in mid, career. You don't have to come in as a 21-year-old. You know, I think we tend to kind of buttonhole that people come in as 21, 22, 23-year-old college graduates, and they teach 35 years, and then they retire, and that's what Para is for. And it's you know, our workforce is much more mobile and much more complicated than that model. I'm on that glide path, but there's a lot of teachers that aren't, and that's it's important to have a plan that's flexible. There's a lot of flexible features to the Para benefit that I won't bore you with because we'll be here all night. But there's a lot of flexible benefits to being in the plan that just don't get much headlines that make it attractive for someone who's coming in at 45 years old to join the plan and to earn a meaningful retirement benefit before they retire. I think for that kind of more stereotypical in people's minds teacher who's coming in at 23, you've got a demographic issue. You've got a population that is less trustful of government organizations than perhaps a 40, 50, or 70-year-old person might be. And one of the benefits to Para is that we actually are investing the money. And by investing the money in a huge pool and paying much smaller fees than individuals could, and by investing in investment vehicles that that individuals cannot access, we're able to generate a return on that money that benefits everyone in the system more than they could do on their own. P period, amen, as my mom used to say, and still does. When you tell someone who is in their 20s that if you become a teacher and you join a school district that you'll pay into Para, and that the retirement benefit doesn't come from Social Security, they go, what? I don't pay into Social Security? Nope. Really, you have them right there. Because if you look at the financials of Social Security and you look at the financials of Para, I'll take Para's financials 8 days a week. So I think that there's, we focus on where we want to be. We focus on, you know, it's a big dollar amount that's owed for services that have already been rendered. And the unfunded liability is here and it must be paid off. And nobody likes talking about it, but it's good fiscal policy to pay it off. But lost in all of that discussion is all the benefits that having Para around has. I think it not only benefits our membership, I think it benefits our employers. I'm trying to figure out, let's take ourselves out of the Denver metro area for a moment. If you're in Sterling or Pueblo and you're trying to attack a teacher and you can't pay them, you guys can't either. I know. I've seen my salary. You can't pay them what they do, right? You can't pay them the dollar amount that you'd like to for what they do. But if they know that when they've worked a career that they can walk away and they're not going to be homeless and they're not going to be without health insurance and they're not going to be destitute, they'll be okay. And that's what Para does. That means something. And we don't want to breach that trust. We want that trust to continue ad infinitum. And this plan, I think, is the best way to make sure that that trust is upheld. And I would much rather offer a new employee Para than any other plan. We had a study. The legislature already did it in 2014. And they said, bar none, this is the best way to generate income. This is the best design plan you could have. It wasn't funded by Para. It was a completely different auditor firm that came in that the legislature asked to come in, and they said, this is the best way to do it. You've got a good plan design.
Mr. Chairman,
we just have to pay for it.
From an HR lens, just a comment. I don't believe Para is helpful in attracting people to the teaching profession. I believe when we talk to young teachers, they actually have a different perspective on career than people who've been in a career. But I believe what Mr. Pinnell is saying, it's a trust issue with our current employees more so than a recruitment issue for our new employees. because any study that's going to look at how we think about attracting people to the teaching industry needs to ask a broader base of questions about how long they're going to be, they anticipate being in the profession, what's attractive to them, what's meaningful to them. What a study that heavily weighs defined benefit plans fails to do is to consider what it might look like shifting to a defined contribution plan. So I think the question may not have been quite aligned with what we see on my team when we talk to new teachers. That does not negate the trust that we have with our current teachers who came to this profession with an expectation about a retirement plan. And the best way that I can describe it is when one of our more senior principals said to me, he said, Amy, when I left college at 23 and I had decided to be a teacher, I had friends who walked out of the door and they went on to have careers as doctors and lawyers and some other pieces. And part of the public trust that I took away with me was a commitment that I would have a future benefit that would have value to me. So you may see this differently, Marcus, and that's fine. I don't think it's an issue for our a recruitment issue. I think it's a trust issue for people who joined the profession years ago with an expectation that it was almost like a deferred earnings type piece for them. And I think this principal said it best when he described it that way to me.
I'd like to echo that. I don't know, about 4 or 5 months ago, I met with a number of not educators, but people that maintain our schools. So these are a lot of association members that are plumbers and HVAC people, and that was one of the messages I received from them loud and clear was, we know that we are earning much less than we can earn out in the private sector doing the work that we're doing, but we're doing it because we know we have a very healthy retirement plan that will support us in the out years. They were very clear and express about that trade-off. They're very conscious that they're making that compensation sacrifice today for the payoff in the future. You said you're trying to put yourself into our shoes for a moment, and I think we have different shoes. And one of the perspectives I come at it is from an employer or a business point of view. And a rule of thumb for an employer in the private sector is that your payroll costs, taxes, and benefits, not including compensation, are going to be somewhere between 12% and 14% of your actual paid compensation. So that's what you're going to pay for FICA. That's what you're going to pay out for Medicare. You know, it's unemployment. Those are the things that roll into that. They don't always include a contribution to any sort of retirement plan. But you have to recognize that some of those costs we still end up paying, you know? And so you're talking about having total payroll taxes and benefit compensation cost, if you put all those things in, of fully a quarter of what we're actually compensating our educators.
I use 30% when I'm talking to candidates on the phone and I'm encouraging them to join JeffCo. And the place where that really resonates is when we're competing for positions that have opportunities in the private sector. So information technology and some of those, when I'm talking to them and they're mid-career changers, that means something to them. Mm-hmm. But we use 30%.
So I was being... it was an underestimate. I was trying careful not to exaggerate. That means that for every dollar we pay you, we're paying 30 cents to all that other stuff. That is expensive for an employer. And no one in the private sector would ever be able to endure that kind of cost, much less choosing to tolerate it. So that's one of the perspectives you have to be aware of. That's why so many people wring their hands over PARA when we go to forums, when we're out running for office, or when we're talking about our budget. People in the private sector, frankly, resent how much PARA costs. So I've heard what you're saying, but you asked for what our perspective is. That's one of the perspectives that we hear a lot.
We are certainly familiar with that perspective.
I'm sure you are.
But we appreciate it, for sure.
Yeah.
I can see that perspective. I absolutely disagree with it because of compensation levels in our teaching profession. And so for that reason, you know, I would disagree. And I want to personally agree with something that you said, Mr. Pinnell. You talked about young people in today's world. I don't know what we call them today. Are they millennials, maybe? The concept is that, you know, maybe they grew up in a different world and they have perhaps a slightly different value system and all that sort of thing. But one of the things I think they do believe, and I hear it all the time from young people, including my son, who is a little older than a young people, and they say things like, you know, Social Security will never be there for me. They do not trust the federal government to maintain that plan, which, as I understand it, currently today benefits 50 million Americans. I don't trust that they'll maintain it either, and I think that's kind of unfortunate. But with the young kids, having another option, i.e. para, can be a choice that makes them feel a little more secure than what they currently feel with Social Security and the federal government. I think we compare very favorably there.
We've done studies, actually, as to this issue of educating the younger generation, and literally what they're saying is if when you tell them you don't pay into Social Security and you pay into something else and just stop there, you're okay. It's when you go on farther and start talking about retirement and what that means, that's when you lose them.
You lose them.
But they do, to echo your point, I think what Marcus is saying, when you say you don't pay into Social Security and that you can actually log onto your account and see the 8% contribution in your account, that means something to them.
That's a payoff, or that's a plus.
Yeah.
Well, and let me say that one of the things that's going to stick with me from tonight is this question of a closed amortization period. This, to me, seems like a significant shift. We owe it to our employees today and our future employees to make sure that we have a good understanding and a good provision for their full compensation package. That said, there is a serious need to be realistic and responsible. And shifting to a perspective with a closed amortization, which wasn't typically, and maybe in many places isn't typical regarding a pension funding system, speaks to me of serious fiscal responsibility and answerability. It's a challenge, and I would say one of our biggest challenges is the finite budget and significant lack of funding that is due our schools. That said, it makes it that much more important that you all are conservative and transparent and deeply self-reflective. So thank you for information about that 2014 study. It looks like a couple different studies were done and reports were released in 2015, so that there's some real legs when we speak to people in our community to say, this is how we know we're being responsible and realistic. In regards to the investment they make in the employees who educate the kids. So that's noteworthy.
Not hearing additional questions, I think I get to say, Mr. Franklin, thank you for being here. Mr. Pinnell, thank you. I really appreciate both of you being here, and I think this session has been very informative for our board and anyone else who's listening. So thanks for spending time with us. We'll probably have you back again.
It was my pleasure.
All right.
Thank you for having us very much.
It was my pleasure anytime.
Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can we take a break?
I don't think so. What do you think? Do you need one?
I do. I need to go to the bathroom.
Okay.
2 minutes.
We are going to take a short recess while we change the presenters to the board. Next will be Mr. Bowditch. We'll get ready for that. We'll take a 5-minute break here, I'm going to say.
Mr. Mitchell, I'm looking forward to concluding this evening's conversation.
Susie Chapstick.
Thank you, Mr. Rupert. Are we up?
Yep.
Okay. Mics are live. At this time, I would like to reconvene our study session. And I want to check, Dr. Glass, are you still with us?
Did he fall asleep?
I am President Mitchell. I've enjoyed the conversation so far. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're a liar.
I'm sorry to catch you off guard like that, Dr. Glass, but thanks for responding. And we are delighted to have you with us, honestly. Moving on now, we'll go to the last item on our study session agenda this evening, which is the update on the ongoing work of the Colorado legislators in the 2018 legislative session. In accordance with Board Exec Policy EL-11, communication and counsel to the board, with respect to providing information and counsel to the board, the superintendent shall not fail to give the board as much information as necessary to allow board members to be adequately informed and supported. And certainly, having an understanding of what is going on this session at the Capitol is a part of that responsibility. I would like to say a warm welcome to Mr. Bowditch, who works hard for us at the Capitol. Ms. Quanback, would you like to add anything else before we begin this conversation or update?
Just thank you for your work and welcome.
Okay. Mr. Bowditch, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, and again, thanks to all the staff. I'm constantly peppering various members of the staff and the superintendent with questions, and I appreciate their diligent responses. Thank you for the invitation to come out tonight. I don't have hours and hours worth of updates here. Today was day 37, so we're moving right along. We've passed the quarter poll, we've had 425 or so bills introduced. There'll be another 300 introduced in the next 2 months or so. One of the big issues that is affecting everything is the debate over transportation funding. You would remember last year there was a proposal to submit a ballot measure to the voters to raise a statewide sales tax that would go to fund transportation. That passed the House, died in the Senate, despite the fact that the Senate president was carrying the bill. This year, with the change in the federal tax laws and Colorado realizing what is expected to be a boost from that, there is more discussion about how much would be appropriate to put into the state's transportation system. More specifically, some legislators are saying we can address all of our transportation infrastructure needs in Colorado without a tax increase. But what that means is, where does funding for education come in? The most important thing that's happened, and I'll start off by reviewing the report I sent on February 10th. Again, I do these weekly updates. Anything that is new or that has changed is listed in green, so you can easily scan and see what's new this week. The most important thing that's happened is the November 1st, modified by January 1st, governor's budget recommendation for next year for $100 million buy-down for the budget stabilization factor. The legislature will not debate that for another few more weeks, and then the JBC, the Joint Budget Committee, won't come to a final recommendation on that until after the March 20th revenue estimates. But in my mind, that makes the most difference. Now, this year, mid-year, local property tax revenues were stronger, $97 million stronger, and the enrollment increase that the state had anticipated was slightly lower than had been anticipated by about $13 million. The Department of Education and the governor recommended that leaving the $13 million in the School Finance Act, that would have been a small boost to all of the school districts. The Legislative Joint Budget Committee couldn't agree on that. It kept voting 3-3 on every measure. The supplemental bill was introduced, and members of the House decided to vote to leave the $13 million in. Passed the House that way, came over to the Senate, they took the $13 million out. So again, it's one of those debates that will have to be settled once the bill ends up back in conference committee by the budget committee. There'll be some compromise on that. Now, I like more money, and I like it sooner if you give me the choice. But again, I don't want to lose sight of the fact that we're arguing about $13 million now while we've got the $100 million negative factor or budget stabilization factor buy down. In my mind, that's the more important question. So I'll keep you updated on that. I'll go ahead and move down the list of a couple of bills I wanted to mention and then can certainly respond to any questions as we go along. Before I do that, I'd like to also mention I do believe there will be a coming debate on PERA. I think the legislature is lining up to have that discussion. I will also say that PERA had its proposal. The governor had his proposal that was consistent with a couple of major differences. And then other legislators have said, let's reform the board, let's move the entire thing to a defined contribution plan. There are other proposals out there. But I believe the starting point for legislative discussions is the PERA proposal with one modification. I believe a lot of legislators are looking to how to transition some PERA members to a defined contribution plan, to a more of a 401k plan. But they recognize, they make it very clear, we don't want to do that if it adds to PERA's unfunded liability. So they're trying to walk that balance of maybe we get some out of the defined benefit plan, but if we do that too much or too quickly, that could affect PERA's funded status, as you just heard. Mm-hmm. So that's the balance. That's the balancing act that this group of legislators, House and Senate members, are informally discussing at this point. There are a lot of discussions yet to come. As you can imagine, you've not only got the State Division, judges, state troopers, higher ed, school districts, other local governments, lots of interested parties. But that PERA debate, I believe, will happen later this session. Moving down to some of the priority legislation, the first one I wanted to mention to you, there were two full-day kindergarten bills that were introduced at the beginning of the session. The Senate bill by Jeff Gozon, Senator Andy Kerr, has already been killed. The House bill is still alive, and again, you'll see that down on House Bill 1088 by Representative Jim Wilson, a Republican former superintendent in Salida, and he's on the Education Committee, and he is passionate about this issue. He introduces it every year. It passed out of the House Education Committee 10-3, but it goes to the House Appropriations Committee. Again, the trade-off you might think about. His bill to increase the funding for full-day kindergarten students, right now we're at 0.58 FTE. This would increase it to 0.66 FTE. That would cost $42 million, just that one change. So if given a choice, somebody might say, do you want your $100 million budget stabilization buy-down, or do you want a $60 million buy-down and we'll increase funding for full-day K? That, in my mind, that would be kind of the choice that the legislature would be looking at. Another interesting bill, House Bill 1130, school district authorized instructors, it was introduced to allow districts to employ non-licensed teachers if they were unable to hire, if they had some sort of a shortage. It gets into committee and suddenly it was changed and it came out of committee. And it allows CDE to license teachers who are coming in from out of state. So they've been licensed in another state, and they've worked for 3 years in another state. It allows a little more flexibility in that regard. At that point, the bill came out of committee. So it's a very different type of bill, and the sponsor was okay with that. And I believe CDE is not opposed to it at this point.
So does that basically just take licensure reciprocity and open it up for CDE to say we can have that with any state if there's been 3 years of service?
I don't know if it's any state, but it opens up the reciprocity. I believe now there's almost, and I'm getting out of my comfort zone, so if anybody else wants to weigh in, and I'm sure there are other experts, I believe now it is a 7-year for other states if you've been licensed for 7 years, and it lowers it to 3. So again, it's just been through one committee. I know that a lot of districts do get teachers move here. A lot of people are moving to Colorado. People may have wanted maybe teachers in other states. Perhaps this would make it easier to hire them. Again, it's just been through one committee.
Do we have any information about other states' licensing requirements? Are they similar to ours? Here's my real question. Do we know if we're going to be doing reciprocity on college-educated licensed teachers?
That is an excellent question.
Okay. I think
I heard, don't know the answer.
I heard the answer.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No, I don't know the answer. Yeah.
If I were to be concerned about anything in that reciprocity agreement, that would be it.
Yeah.
I don't want to see us lower the standards for the teaching profession. I believe it's important to keep them high.
Yeah.
Amy?
So one of the things I was going to say, and I so appreciate that one of the lenses that our board has is that we have a broader concern than just Jeffco. I don't know what the state reciprocity is because we don't have challenges hiring teachers with CDE licensures. So, again, it's one of the nice things about our board is you're concerned about more than just Jeffco because it's in the rural areas of the state where they've really struggled to get people through those licensure programs. Yeah. So I'll have my team start digging in on this a little bit as well because it's interesting to me. You know, teacher licenses, there's an initial license, there's a professional license, you know, there's various stages along the way of that. So I'll dig further myself as well.
Yeah, thank you.
Super.
Another bill I wanted to highlight, two bills were introduced by Representative Dave Young, who is a House member from Greeley. And one of them you can see on the bottom of page one, House Bill 1197, the student-centered accountability. This is basically allowing a pilot program, authorizes anybody to do a pilot accountability program. Sets out the parameters that CDE must use to approve that. It also, interestingly, changes the, under current law, remember from Senate Bill 191, at least 50% of a licensed personnel's evaluation must be based on student growth measures. This changes it so that it's at least 20%, but not more than 50%. I've seen, with all due respect to this bill, I've seen lots of proposed changes to Senate Bill 191, and with this legislature, they have a tough time. I think this bill will have a tough time as well. I did want to call out to your attention on page two, House Bill 1232, the new school finance funding distribution formula. The superintendents have been working on this for at least a couple of years. As of this point, I believe roughly 170 or 175 superintendents have signed on to this. This changes the School Finance Act contingent on a statewide ballot measure passing that would support K-12 education. So if this bill passes, it will sit on the books. I believe it would be repealed in 2022. But a ballot measure would have to pass, providing sufficient funding to implement this rewrite of the School Finance Act. There are many different components of this School Finance Act. Just to name a few, as you know, the School Finance Act, our current act, was written in 1994. It is in badly in need of an update, in my opinion. There are a lot of things that don't make sense, but without, frankly, a large infusion of dollars, you can't tinker with the current act without creating winners and losers. And in this environment, a lot of people say we really can't open up the act for much change. This is a different way about it. They created the new act. It's more of a student-centered act. Does a lot of different things, changes cost of living factor, size factor. At-risk would be broadened to not just include those students qualifying for free lunch, but also those students qualifying for reduced lunch. For example, I know the Superintendent Glass has been an integral part of these discussions. Again, this has not been scheduled. I don't anticipate it will come up in the next couple of weeks. I think we're a few weeks away, but that can change as well.
I do want to highlight that I saw that the Denver Post editorial board also read this proposed legislation and saw some significant, positive, bipartisan work that represents the voices from across the state. I was encouraged by that.
So really, Mr. Chair and members, those are the bills I wanted to bring to your attention and the topics I wanted to discuss, but I'm happy to respond to any questions you might have on any topic.
Okay. Questions or issues, colleagues?
Mr. Chair, I have a disclosure to make. I testified at the legislature today on SB 118 and shared with the board and Dr. Glass what my comments would be by email earlier today, and so I can get those to Helen so they can be shared, published, what have you, so that everyone's on the same page on that. The idea of that bill, I was asked to testify to share our experience a year ago with the application of a charter school, our initial rejection of that application, why we rejected it, what happened when it was remanded to us, and this bill, its intent is to remove the second appeal to the state board and leave the decision-making authority in the hands of the school boards, which is part of our general blanket direction for advocacy, and I think consistent with the state's constitution.
Did you have a great time?
I had a great time, yes.
I think it's good that we make the case for local control, Mr. Ripper.
Right.
Anything else?
I do want to just voice my encouragement and excitement over really what I see as a step toward fruition. I know that when it comes to the advocacy of state superintendents, we saw something exciting happen a couple years ago when a $1 billion negative factor became $250 million smaller as a result of that advocacy. And that our superintendent said, we're going to take our core competency of understanding what it takes to adequately and equitably fund our schools so that our students are able to fulfill their potential. And they've worked diligently across a lot of differences, small districts, large districts, highly diverse districts, more homogenous districts, to find a plan and a solution that's grounded in the best work that can be done for students. So I'm looking forward to watching as this particular conversation moves forward. And I will watch with some optimism, knowing that the groundwork that's been laid for a plan, for a solution to something that we've been talking about really only as a problem instead of being able to be as solutions-oriented as we wanted to, seems to have some traction for an actual solution. So my thanks to all the superintendents who have wrangled with this sticky widget. And I'm hopeful and watching, hopefully.
Mr. Chairman, the other interesting thing to think about, I've heard the number of $1.4, $1.5 billion that is needed in that range, give or take $100 million, in that range to make this new School Finance Act work. That's an awfully big number. And then you think, well, gosh, half that is the budget stabilization factor that they owe us anyway. So just an interesting way to think about it.
Lots of ways to look at that.
Yep.
And it does, I think, get us only about 60%, maybe 65% closer to the national average. Even with that influx of money, we still wouldn't reach that, but it sure would bend the learning curve in the right direction, and the investment curve in the right direction for kids.
And Mr. Bowditch, you were probably in the room. We just heard a presentation from PARA. Mm-hmm. I think they did a nice job of presenting the issues. And we understand, of course, that the legislature will make the final decision on this. But I think that this whole idea that we can take some people coming into the system and take them out of PARA and put them in a defined contribution of plan of some kind or another, I think that's the discussion that's occurring. It does weaken our ability to ultimately realize the goal of being 100% actuarially funded. As a result, I'm going to ask that you please keep us posted on those discussions. And I would think that if there is a time when it is appropriate for us to, try to weigh in or take a position, that you would advise us of such.
Okay. I would say, and Mr. Chairman, you haven't asked me, but one point I would make about that PARA proposal and what I've been thinking about, and I've had a lot of discussions with Ms. Askelson, I personally get a little nervous with the provision, and I'm stepping way out of my role here, but with the provision that would allow a readjustment based on market factors, allow a changing of the rates. If what I heard correctly today, if based on a June financial statement, PARA would then have the ability to make a change, let's say an increase in the employer contribution rate of 0.5% 7 months from then in January, I'm guessing you would have to have a larger reserve to account for that every year, just in case that happened. Now, there'd be benefits to having a larger reserve. If you put the reserve aside once, it would be there, and all those things. And I recognize that would be a benefit to PARA to have them not have to go back to the legislature every time there's a fluctuation. But I'd still be very careful about that in my own mind.
I'd like to chime in and say I agree with that. I am extremely nervous of an autopilot feature on this, and that at any point it would be good to review all of the different facts. It's not always a clear path on how we should end up with the funded liability on this.
So a couple of words of caution on the automatic adjustment component of the proposal.
Right. The other piece I would say, anything that would require increases from the employer, and frankly for the employee either, but especially from the employer, I know that all the public entities, such as Jeffco Public Schools, are in the process of putting together their budget for next year. If it is possible, if there are going to be increases, not to keep kicking the can down the road, but make those effective not on July 1st of this year, because I think that could throw you guys for a loop if on the last night of the session some PARA bill passes and suddenly you've got to modify your budget. That would be something you'd have to consider. So,
especially if that were modified by a percentage of our salary budget, which is 80% of our budget anyway.
Yeah.
And so you talk about adding 2% to 80% of our budget. I think, Kathleen, Ms. Askelson would find that a fairly significant development.
Yeah. And the PARA proposal did not have that going into effect on July 1, 2019. The governor's proposal expedited the contribution increases, if I remember correctly. But more people are talking about the PARA proposal as the baseline for the discussions.
Okay. I would ask, please keep us posted on that one. It's, as you identified, it's an important discussion at the Capitol this year.
Yeah.
Anything else, colleagues? I think then it's time for us to say thank you, Mr. Bowditch. We appreciate the work you do, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
That leads me to want to say, Dr. Glass, we're about to close this meeting. Is there anything you need to say over the telephone before we do that?
I really enjoyed the conversation tonight. I think you guys heard from three really weighty presentations around finance and PARA and the legislative session, all of which center around really financial issues for this year and then the long term ahead. There's a lot of moving parts still at play, but you've got great people working on all these things.
Thank you, Dr. Glass. Ms. Quanbeck, anything? It's dangerous to add after the superintendent speaks, but you're here with us, so you get that opportunity.
I'll echo the great presentations that we heard tonight, very informative, and I thank the guests who came in.
Okay. With that, I'm going to say thank you, board members. This meeting is now adjourned.